looked in and said, "Jackie," disapprovingly, but I said, "No, no, it's okay," because it totally was. And then Jackie asked, "Would they help me breathe too?" "I don't know. Let's try." I took it off and let Jackie stick the cannula in her nose and breathe. "Tickles," she said.
"I know, right?"
"I think I'm breathing better," she said.
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
"Well," I said, "I wish I could give you my cannula, but I kind of really need the help."
I already felt the loss. I focused on my breathing as Jackie handed the tubes back to me. I gave them a quick swipe with my t-shirt, laced the tubes behind my ears, and put the nubbins back in place.
"Thanks for letting me try it," she said.
"No problem."
"Jackie," her mother said again, and this time I let her go. I returned to the book, where Staff Sergeant Max Mayhem was regretting that he had but one life to give for his country, but I kept thinking about that little kid and how much I liked her. The other thing about Caitlin, I guess, was that it could never again feel natural to talk to her. Any attempts to feign normal social interactions were just depressing because it was so glaringly obvious that everyone I spoke to for the rest of my life would feel awkward and self-conscious around me. Except maybe kids like Jackie, who just didn't know any better. Anyway, I really did like being alone. I liked being alone with poor Staff Sergeant Max Mayhem, who, oh come on, he's not going to survive these 17 bullet wounds, is he? Spoiler alert, he lives. Chapter 4. I went to bed a little early that night, changing into boy boxers and a t-shirt before crawling under the covers of my bed, which was queen-size and pillow-topped and one of my favorite places in the world. And then I started reading An Imperial Affliction for the millionth time. AIA is about this girl named Anna, who narrates the story, and her one-eyed mom, who is a professional gardener obsessed with tulips. And they have a normal lower-middle-class life in a little central California town until Anna gets this rare blood cancer. But it's not a cancer book, because cancer books suck. Like, in cancer books, the cancer person starts a charity that raises money to fight cancer, right? And this commitment to charity reminds the cancer person of the essential goodness of humanity and makes him or her feel loved and encouraged because she or he will leave a cancer-curing legacy. But in AIA, Anna decides that being a person with cancer who starts a cancer charity is a bit narcissistic. So she starts a charity called the Anna Foundation for People with Cancer Who Want to Cure Cholera. Also, Anna is honest about all of it in a way no one else really is. Throughout the book, she refers to herself as the side effect, which is just totally correct. Cancer kids are essentially side effects of the relentless mutation that made the diversity of life on Earth possible. So as the story goes on, she gets sicker, the treatments and disease racing to kill her. And her mom falls in love with this Dutch tulip trader Anna calls the Dutch Tulip Man. The Dutch Tulip Man has lots of money and very eccentric ideas about how to treat cancer, but Anna thinks this guy might be a con man and possibly not even Dutch. And then just as the possibly Dutch guy and her mom are about to get married and Anna is about to start this crazy new treatment regimen involving wheatgrass and low doses of arsenic, the book ends right in the middle of a... I know it's a very literary decision and everything, and probably part of the reason I love the book so much, but there is something to recommend a story that ends. And if it can't end, then it should at least continue into perpetuity like the adventures of Staff Sergeant Max Mayhem's platoon. I understood the story ended because Anna died or got too sick to write, and this mid-sentence thing was supposed to reflect how life really ends and whatever, but there were characters other than Anna in the story, and it seemed unfair that I would never find out what happened to them. I'd written, care of his publisher, a dozen letters to Peter Van Houten, each asking for some answers about what happens after the end of the story, whether the Dutch tulip man is a con man, whether Anna's mother ends up married to him, what happens to Anna's stupid hamster, which her mom hates, whether Anna's friends graduate from high school, all that stuff. But he'd never responded to any of my letters. AIA was the only book Peter Van Houten had written, and all anyone seemed to know about him was that after the book came out, he moved from the United States to the Netherlands and became kind of reclusive. I imagined that he was working on a sequel set in the Netherlands. Maybe Anna's mom and the Dutch tulip man end up moving there and trying to start a new life. But it had been 10 years since An Imperial Affliction came out, and Van Houten hadn't published so much as a blog post. I couldn't wait forever. As I reread that night, I kept getting distracted imagining Augustus Waters reading the same words. I wondered if he'd like it, or if he'd dismiss it as pretentious. Then I remembered my promise to call him after reading The Price of Dawn, so I found his number on its title page and texted him. Price of Dawn review. Too many bodies, not enough adjectives. How's AIA? He replied a minute later. As I recall, you promised to call when you finished the book, not text. So I called. Hazel Grace, he said upon picking up. So have you read it? Well, I haven't finished it. It's 651 pages long, and I've had 24 hours. How far are you? 453. And? I will withhold judgment until I finish. However, I will say that I'm feeling a bit embarrassed to have given you The Price of Dawn. Don't be. I'm already on Requiem for Mayhem. A sparkling addition to the series. So, okay. Is the tulip guy a crook? I'm getting a bad vibe from him. No spoilers, I said. If he is anything other than a total gentleman, I'm going to gouge his eyes out. So you're into it. Withholding judgment. When can I see you? Certainly not until you finish An Imperial Affliction. I enjoyed being coy. Then I'd better hang up and start reading. You'd better, I said. And the line clicked dead without another word. Flirting was new to me, but I liked it. The next morning I had 20th Century American Poetry at MCC. This old woman gave a lecture wherein she managed to talk for 90 minutes about Sylvia Plath without ever once quoting a single word of Sylvia Plath. When I got out of class, Mom was idling at the curb in front of the building. "Did you just wait here the entire time?" I asked as she hurried around to help me haul my cart and tank into the car. "No, I picked up the dry cleaning and went to the post office." "And then?" "I have a book to read," she said, "and I'm the one who needs to get a life." I smiled, and she tried to smile back, but there was something flimsy in it. After a second, I said, "Want to go to a movie?" "Sure. Anything you've been wanting to see?" "Let's just do the thing where we go and see whatever starts next." She closed the door for me and walked around to the driver's side. We drove over to the Castleton Theater and watched a 3D movie about talking gerbils. It was kind of funny, actually. When I got out of the movie, I had 4 text messages from Augustus. "Tell me my copy is missing the last 20 pages or something." "Hazel Grace, tell me I have not reached the end of this book." "Oh my God, do they get married or not? Oh my God, what is this?" "I guess Anna died and so it just ends." "Cruel. Call me when you can. Hope all's okay." So when I got home, I went out into the backyard and sat down on this rusting, latticed patio chair and called him. It was a cloudy day, typical Indiana, the kind of weather that boxes you in. Our little backyard was dominated by my childhood swing set, which was looking pretty waterlogged and pathetic. Augustus picked up on the third ring. "Hazel Grace," he said. "So, welcome to the sweet torture of reading An Imperial..." I stopped when I heard violent sobbing on the other end of the line. "Are you okay?" I asked.
"I'm grand," Augustus answered. "I am, however, with Isaac, who seems to be decompensating."
More wailing, like the death cries of some injured animal. Gus turned his attention to Isaac.
Dude, does support group Hazel make this better or worse? Isaac, focus on me."
After a minute, Gus said to me, "Can you meet us at my house in, say, 20 minutes?
"Sure,"
I said, and hung up. If you could drive in a straight line, it would only take like 5 minutes to get from my house to Augustus's house, but you can't drive in a straight line because Holiday Park is between us. Even though it was a geographic inconvenience, I really liked Holiday Park. When I was a little kid, I would wade in the White River with my dad, and there was always this great moment when he would throw me up in the air, just toss me away from him, and I would reach out my arms as I flew, and he would reach out his arms, and then we would both see that our arms were not going to touch, and no one was going to catch me, and it would kind of scare the shit out of both of us in the best possible way. And then I would legs flailingly hit the water and then come up for air uninjured. And the current would bring me back to him as I said, "Again, Daddy, again!" I pulled into the driveway right next to an old black Toyota sedan I figured was Isaac's car. Carting the tank behind me, I walked up to the door. I knocked. Gus's dad answered.
"Just Hazel," he said. "Nice to see you."
"Augustus said I could come over?"
"Yeah, he and Isaac are in the basement."
At which point there was a wail from below.
"That would be Isaac," Gus's dad said, and shook his head slowly. "Cindy had to go for a drive. The sound," he said, drifting off. "Anyway, I guess you're wanted downstairs. Can I carry your, tank?" he asked.
"Nah, I'm good. Thanks, though, Mr. Waters."
"Mark," he said.
I was kind of scared to go down there. Listening to people howl in misery is not among my favorite pastimes, but I went.
"Hazel Grace," Augustus said as he heard my footsteps. "Isaac, Hazel from support group is coming downstairs.
Hazel, a gentle reminder, Isaac is in the midst of a psychotic episode."
Augustus and Isaac were sitting on the floor in gaming chairs shaped like lazy L's, staring up at a gargantuan television. The screen was split between Isaac's point of view on the left and Augustus's on the right. They were soldiers fighting in a bombed-out modern city. I recognized the place from The Price of Dawn. As I approached, I saw nothing unusual. Just two guys sitting in the light wash of a huge television pretending to kill people. Only when I got parallel to them did I see Isaac's face. Tears streamed down his reddened cheeks in a continual flow, his face a taut mask of pain. He stared at the screen, not even glancing at me, and howled, all the while pounding away at his controller.
"How are you, Hazel?"
asked Augustus.
"I'm okay," I said. "Isaac?"
No response. Not even the slightest hint that he was aware of my existence. Just the tears flowing down his face onto his black t-shirt. Augustus glanced away from the screen ever so briefly.
"You look nice," he said.
I was wearing this just-past-the-knees dress I'd had forever. Girls think they're only allowed to wear dresses on formal occasions, but I like a woman who says, you know, "I'm going over to see a boy who is having a nervous breakdown, a boy whose connection to the sense of sight itself is tenuous, and gosh dang it, I am going to wear a dress for him."
"And yet," I said, "Isaac won't so much as glance over at me. Too in love with Monica, I suppose."
Which resulted in a catastrophic sob.
"Bit of a touchy subject," Augustus explained. "Isaac, I don't know about you, but I have the vague sense that we are being outflanked."
And then back to me. "Isaac and Monica are no longer a going concern, but he doesn't want to talk about it. He just wants to cry and play Counterinsurgents 2, The Price of Dawn."
"Fair enough," I said.
"Isaac, I feel a growing concern about our position. If you agree, head over to that power station and I'll cover you." Isaac ran toward a nondescript building while Augustus fired a machine gun wildly in a series of quick bursts, running behind him.
"Anyway," Augustus said to me, "it doesn't hurt to talk to him, if you have any sage words of feminine advice."
"I actually think his response is probably appropriate," I said as a burst of gunfire from Isaac killed an enemy who'd peeked his head out from behind the burned-out husk of a pickup truck.
Augustus nodded at the screen. "Pain demands to be felt," he said, which was a line from An Imperial Affliction.
"You're sure there's no one behind us?"
he asked Isaac. Moments later, tracer bullets started whizzing over their heads.
"Oh, God damn it, Isaac," Augustus said. "I don't mean to criticize you in your moment of great weakness, but you've allowed us to be outflanked, and now there's nothing between the terrorists and the school."
Isaac's character took off running toward the fire, zigging and zagging down a narrow alleyway.
"You could go over the bridge and circle back," I said,
a tactic I knew about thanks to The Price of Dawn. Augustus sighed. "Sadly, the bridge is already under insurgent control due to questionable strategizing by my bereft cohort."
"Me?"
Isaac said, his voice breathy.
"Me? You're the one who suggested we hole up in the freaking power station."
Gus turned away from the screen for a second and flashed his crooked smile at Isaac.
"I knew you could talk, buddy," he said. "Now let's go save some fictional schoolchildren."
Together, they ran down the alleyway, firing and hiding at the right moments, until they reached this one-story, single-room schoolhouse. They crouched behind a wall across the street and picked off the enemy one by one.
"Why do they want to get into the school?" I asked.
"They want the kids as hostages," Augustus answered.
His shoulders rounded over his controller, slamming buttons, his forearms taut, veins visible. Isaac leaned toward the screen, the controller dancing in his thin-fingered hands.
"Get it, get it, get it," Augustus said.
The waves of terrorists continued, and they mowed down every one. Their shooting astonishingly precise, as it had to be, lest they fire into the school.
"Grenade! Grenade!" Augustus shouted as something arced across the screen, bounced in the doorway of the school, and then rolled against the door.
Isaac dropped his controller in disappointment.
"If the bastards can't take hostages, they'll just kill them and claim we did it."
"Cover me!" Augustus said as he jumped out from behind the wall and raced toward the school. Isaac fumbled for his controller and then started firing while the bullets rained down on Augustus, who was shot once and then twice but still ran, Augustus shouting, "You can't kill Max Mayhem!" And with a final flurry of button combinations, he dove onto the grenade, which detonated beneath him. His dismembered body exploded like a geyser and the screen went red. A throaty voice said, "Mission failure." But Augustus seemed to think otherwise as he smiled at his remnants on the screen. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a cigarette, and shoved it between his teeth.
"Saved the kids," he said.
"Temporarily," I pointed out.
"All salvation is temporary," Augustus shot back. "I bought them a minute. Maybe that's the minute that buys them an hour, which is the hour that buys them a year. No one's gonna buy them forever, Hazel Grace, but my life bought them a minute, and that's not nothing."
"Whoa, okay," I said. "We're just talking about pixels." He shrugged, as if he believed the game might be really real. Isaac was wailing again. Augustus snapped his head back to him.
"Another go at the mission, Corporal?"
Isaac shook his head no. He leaned over Augustus to look at me and through tightly strung vocal cords said,
"She didn't want to do it after."
"She didn't want to dump a blind guy," I said. He nodded. The tears not like tears so much as a quiet metronome, steady, endless.
"She said she couldn't handle it," he told me. "I'm about to lose my eyesight, and she can't handle it."
I was thinking about the word handle, and all the unholdable things that get handled.
"I'm sorry," I said.
He wiped his sopping face with a sleeve. Behind his glasses, Isaac's eyes seemed so big that everything else on his face kind of disappeared, and it was just these disembodied floating eyes staring at me, one real, one glass.
"It's unacceptable," he told me. "It's totally unacceptable."
"Well, to be fair," I said, "I mean, she probably can't handle it. Neither can you, but she doesn't have to handle it, and you do."
I kept saying always to her today. Always, always, always. And she just kept talking over me and not saying it back. It was like I was already gone, you know? Always was a promise. How can you just break the promise?
"Sometimes people don't understand the promises they're making when they make them," I said. Isaac shot me a look.
"Right, of course. But you keep the promise anyway. That's what love is. Love is keeping the promise anyway. Don't you believe in true love?"
I didn't answer. I didn't have an answer. But I thought that if true love did exist, that was a pretty good definition of it.
"Well, I believe in true love," Isaac said. "And I love her. And she promised. She promised me always."
He stood and took a step toward me. I pushed myself up, thinking he wanted a hug or something, but then he just spun around like he couldn't remember why he'd stood up in the first place, and then Augustus and I both saw this rage settle into his face.
"Isaac," Gus said.
"What?"
"You look a little... pardon the double entendre, my friend, but there's something a little worrisome in your eyes."
Suddenly Isaac started kicking the crap out of his gaming chair, which somersaulted back toward Gus's bed.
"Here we go," said Augustus.
Isaac chased after the chair and kicked it again.
"Yes,"
Augustus said.
"Get it. Kick the shit out of that chair." Isaac kicked the chair again until it bounced against Gus's bed, and then he grabbed one of the pillows and started slamming it against the wall between the bed and the trophy shelf above. Augustus looked over at me, cigarette still in his mouth, and half smiled.
I can't stop thinking about that book.
I know, right?
He never said what happens to the other characters.
No, I told him. Isaac was still throttling the wall with the pillow. He moved to Amsterdam, which makes me think that maybe he is writing a sequel featuring the Dutch tulip man. But he hasn't published anything. He's never interviewed. He doesn't seem to be online. I've written him a bunch of letters asking what happens to everyone, but he never responds. So, yeah. I stopped talking because Augustus didn't appear to be listening. Instead, he was squinting at Isaac.
Hold on,
he mumbled to me. He walked over to Isaac and grabbed him by the shoulders.
Dude, pillows don't break. Try something that breaks.
Isaac reached for a basketball trophy from the shelf above the bed and then held it over his head as if waiting for permission.
Yes,
Augustus said.
Yes.
The trophy smashed against the floor, the plastic basketball player's arm splintering off, still grasping its ball. Isaac stomped on the trophy.
Yes, Augustus said. Get it.
And then back to me.
I've been looking for a way to tell my father that I actually sort of hate basketball, and I think we've found it.
The trophies came down one after the other, and Isaac stomped on them and screamed while Augustus and I stood a few feet away, bearing witness to the madness. The poor, mangled bodies of plastic basketballers littered the carpeted ground. Here, a ball palmed by a disembodied hand. There, two torsoless legs caught mid-jump. Isaac kept attacking the trophies, jumping on them with both feet, screaming, breathless, sweaty, until finally he collapsed on top of the jagged trophic remnants. Augustus stepped toward him and looked down.
Feel better? He asked.
No,
Isaac mumbled, his chest heaving.
That's the thing about pain,
Augustus said, and then glanced back at me.
It demands to be felt.
Chapter 5. I did not speak to Augustus again for about a week. I had called him on the night of the broken trophies, so per tradition it was his turn to call. But he didn't. Now, it wasn't as if I held my phone in my sweaty hand all day, staring at it while wearing my special yellow dress, patiently waiting for my gentleman caller to live up to his sobriquet. I went about my life. I met Caitlin and her cute but frankly not Augustinian boyfriend for coffee one afternoon. I ingested my recommended daily allowance of phalanxophore. I attended classes 3 mornings that week at MCC, and every night I sat down to dinner with my mom and dad. Sunday night, we had pizza with green peppers and broccoli. We were seated around our little circular table in the kitchen when my phone started singing, but I wasn't allowed to check it because we have a strict no-phones-during-dinner rule. So I ate a little while Mom and Dad talked about this earthquake that had just happened in Papua New Guinea. They met in the Peace Corps in Papua New Guinea, and so whenever anything happened there, even something terrible, it was like all of a sudden they were not large, sedentary creatures, but the young and idealistic and self-sufficient and rugged people they had once been, and their rapture was such that they didn't even glance over at me as I ate faster than I'd ever eaten, transmitting items from my plate into my mouth with a speed and ferocity that left me quite out of breath, which of course made me worry that my lungs were again swimming in a rising pool of fluid. I banished the thought as best I could. I had a PET scan scheduled in a couple weeks. If something was wrong, I'd find out soon enough. Nothing to be gained by worrying between now and then. And yet still, I worried. I liked being a person. I wanted to keep at it. Worry is yet another side effect of dying. Finally, I finished and said, "Can I be excused?" And they hardly even paused from their conversation about the strengths and weaknesses of Guinean infrastructure. I grabbed my phone from my purse on the kitchen counter and checked my recent calls. Augustus Waters. I went out the back door into the twilight. I could see the swing set, and I thought about walking out there and swinging while I talked to him, but it seemed pretty far away given that eating tired me. Instead, I lay down in the grass at the patio's edge, looked up at Orion, the only constellation I could recognize, and called him.
"Hazel Grace," he said.
"Hi," I said.
How are you?
Grand, he said. I have been wanting to call you on a nearly minutely basis, but I have been waiting until I could form a coherent thought in re an imperial affliction.
He said, in re.
He really did. That boy.
And?
I said. I think it's like, reading it, I just kept feeling like,
like?
I asked, teasing him.
Like it was a gift?
He said askingly.
Like you'd given me something important.
Oh, I said quietly.
That's cheesy, he said. I'm sorry.
No, I said. No, don't apologize.
But it doesn't end.
Yeah, I said.
Torture. I totally get it. Like, I get that she died or whatever.
Right, I assume so, I said.
And okay, fair enough. But there is this unwritten contract between author and reader, and I think not ending your book kind of violates that contract.
I don't know, I said, feeling defensive of Peter Van Outen. That's part of what I like about the book in some ways. It portrays death truthfully. You die in the middle of your life, in the middle of a sentence. But I do, God, I do really want to know what happens to everyone else. That's what I asked him in my letters, but he never answers.
Right. You said he is a recluse?
Correct.
Impossible to track down.
Correct.
Utterly unreachable, Augustus said.
Unfortunately so, I said.
Dear Mr. Waters, he answered, I am writing to thank you for your electronic correspondence, received via Ms. Vliegenthart this 6th of April from the United States of America. Insofar as geography can be said to exist in our triumphantly digitized contemporaneity.
Augustus, what the hell?
He has an assistant, Augustus said. Litowidge Vliegenthart. I found her. I emailed her. She gave him the email. He responded via her email account.
Okay, keep reading.
My response is being written with ink and paper in the glorious tradition of our ancestors and then transcribed by Ms. Vliegenthart into a series of ones and zeros to travel through the insipid web, which has lately ensnared our species. So I apologize for any errors or omissions that may result. Given the entertainment bacchanalia at the disposal of young men and women of your generation, I am grateful to anyone, anywhere, who sets aside the hours necessary to read my little book. But I am particularly indebted to you, sir, both for your kind words about an imperial affliction and for taking the time to tell me that the book, and here I quote you directly, meant a great deal to you. This comment, however, leads me to wonder, what do you mean by meant? Given the final futility of our struggle, is the fleeting jolt of meaning that art gives us valuable? Or is the only value in passing the time as comfortably as possible? What should a story seek to emulate, Augustus? A ringing alarm? A call to arms? A morphine drip? Of course, like all interrogation of the universe, this line of inquiry inevitably reduces us to asking what it means to be human and whether, to borrow a phrase from the angst-encumbered 16-year-old you no doubt revile, there is a point to it all. I fear there is not, my friend, and that you would receive scant encouragement from further encounters with my writing. But to answer your question, no, I have not written anything else, nor will I. I do not feel that continuing to share my thoughts with readers would benefit either them or me. Thank you again for your generous email. Yours most sincerely, Peter Van Houten, via Litowidge Vliegenthart.
Wow, I said. Are you making this up?
Hazel Grace, could I, with my meager intellectual capacities, make up a letter from Peter Van Houten featuring phrases like, our triumphantly digitized contemporaneity?
You could not, I allowed. Can I have the email address?
Of course, Augustus said, like it was not the best gift ever.
I spent the next 2 hours writing an email to Peter Van Houten. It seemed to get worse each time I rewrote it, but I couldn't stop myself. Dear Mr. Peter Van Houten, care of Litowidge Vliegenthart. My name is Hazel Grace Lancaster. My friend Augustus Waters, who read An Imperial Affliction at my recommendation, just received an email from you at this address. I hope you will not mind that Augustus shared that email with me. Mr. Van Houten, I understand from your email to Augustus that you are not planning to publish any more books. In a way, I am disappointed, but I'm also relieved. I never have to worry whether your next book will live up to the magnificent perfection of the original. As a 3-year survivor of stage 4 cancer, I can tell you that you got everything right in An Imperial Affliction. Or at least you got me right. Your book has a way of telling me what I'm feeling before I even feel it, and I've reread it dozens of times. I wonder, though, if you would mind answering a couple questions I have about what happens after the end of the novel. I understand the book ends because Anna dies or becomes too ill to continue writing it, but I would really like to know what happens to Anna's mom, whether she married the Dutch tulip man, whether she ever has another child, and whether she stays at 917 West Temple, etc. Also, is the Dutch tulip man a fraud, or does he really love them? What happens to Anna's friends, particularly Claire and Jake? Do they stay together? And lastly, I realize that this is the kind of deep and thoughtful question you always hoped your readers would ask. What becomes of Sisyphus the hamster? These questions have haunted me for years, and I don't know how long I have left to get answers to them. I know these are not important literary questions and that your book is full of important literary questions, but I would just really like to know. And of course, if you ever do decide to write anything else, even if you don't want to publish it, I'd love to read it. Frankly, I'd read your grocery lists. Yours with great admiration, Hazel Grace Lancaster, age 16. After I sent it, I called Augustus back, and we stayed up late talking about An Imperial Affliction, and I read him the Emily Dickinson poem that Van Houten had used for the title, and he said I had a good voice for reading and didn't pause too long for the line breaks, and then he told me that the 6th Price of Dawn book, The Blood Approves, begins with a quote from a poem. It took him a minute to find the book, but finally he read the quote to me. "Say your life broke down. The last good kiss you had was years ago." "Not bad," I said. "Bit pretentious. I believe Max Mayhem would refer to that as sissy shit." "Yes, with his teeth gritted, no doubt. God, Mayhem grits his teeth a lot in these books. He's definitely going to get TMJ if he survives all this combat." And then, after a second, Gus asked, "When was the last good kiss you had?" I thought about it. My kissing, all pre-diagnosis, had been uncomfortable and slobbery, and on some level it always felt like kids playing at being grown. But of course it had been a while. "Years ago," I said finally. "You?" "I had a few good kisses with my ex-girlfriend, Caroline Mathers." "Years ago?" "The last one was just less than a year ago." "What happened?"
"During the kiss?"
"No, with you and Caroline."
"Oh,"
he said.
And then after a second, "Caroline is no longer suffering from personhood."
"Oh," I said.
"Yeah," he said.
"I'm sorry," I said. I'd known plenty of dead people, of course, but I'd never dated one. I couldn't even imagine it, really.
"Not your fault, Hazel Grace. We're all just side effects, right?"
"Barnacles on the container ship of consciousness," I said, quoting AIA.
"Okay," he said. "I gotta go to sleep. It's almost 1.
"Okay," I said.
"Okay," he said.
I giggled and said, "Okay." And then the line was quiet but not dead. I almost felt like he was there in my room with me, but in a way it was better. Like I was not in my room and he was not in his, but instead we were together in some invisible and tenuous third space that could only be visited on the phone.
"Okay," he said after forever. "Maybe okay will be our always."
"Okay," I said. It was Augustus who finally hung up. Peter Van Houten replied to Augustus's email 4 hours after he sent it. But 2 days later, Van Houten still hadn't replied to me. Augustus assured me it was because my email was better and required a more thoughtful response, that Van Houten was busy writing answers to my questions, and that brilliant prose took time. But still I worried. On Wednesday during American Poetry for Dummies 101, I got a text from Augustus. "Isaac out of surgery. It went well. He's officially NEC. NEC meant
No evidence of cancer. A second text came a few seconds later.
I mean, he's blind, so that's unfortunate.
That afternoon, Mom consented to loan me the car so I could drive down to Memorial to check in on Isaac. I found my way to his room on the fifth floor, knocking even though the door was open, and a woman's voice said, "Come in." It was a nurse who was doing something to the bandages on Isaac's eyes.
"Hey, Isaac," I said.
And he said, "Mom?"
"Oh, no, sorry. No, it's, Hazel. Support group Hazel? Knight of the Broken Trophies Hazel?"
"Oh," he said. "Yeah, people keep saying my other senses will improve to compensate, but clearly not yet." "Hi, support group Hazel. Come over here so I can examine your face with my hands and see deeper into your soul than a sighted person ever could."
"He's kidding," the nurse said.
"Yes," I said. "I realize." I took a few steps toward the bed. I pulled a chair up and sat down, took his hand.
"Hey,"
I said. "Hey," he said back. Then nothing for a while.
"How you feeling?"
I asked. "Okay," he said. "I don't know."
"You don't know what?"
I asked. I looked at his hand because I didn't want to look at his face blindfolded by bandages. Isaac bit his nails, and I could see some blood on the corners of a couple of his cuticles. "She hasn't even visited," he said. "I mean, we were together 14 months. 14 months is a long time."
"God, that hurts."
Isaac let go of my hand to fumble for his pain pump, which you hit to give yourself a wave of narcotics. The nurse, having finished the bandage change, stepped back.
"It's only been a day, Isaac," she said, vaguely condescending. "You've got to give yourself time to heal, and 14 months isn't that long, not in the scheme of things. You're just getting started, buddy. You'll see."
The nurse left. "Is she gone?"
I nodded, then realized he couldn't see me nod.
"Yeah," I said.
"I'll see."
"Really? Did she seriously say that?"
"Qualities of a good nurse. Go," I said.
"Number one, doesn't pun on your disability," Isaac said.
"Two, gets blood on the first try," I said.
"Seriously, that is huge. I mean, is this my freaking arm or a dartboard?" "Three, no condescending voice."
"How are you doing, sweetie?"
I asked, cloying.
"I'm going to stick you with a needle now. There might be a little ouchy."
"Is my little fluffy wump sicky wicky?" he answered. And then after a second, "Most of them are good, actually. I just want the hell out of this place."
"This place is in the hospital?"
"That too," he said.
His mouth tightened. I could see the pain.
"Honestly, I think a hell of a lot more about Monica than my eye. Is that crazy?"
"That's crazy."
"It's a little crazy," I allowed.
"But I believe in true love, you know? I don't believe that everybody gets to keep their eyes or not get sick or whatever, but everybody should have true love, and it should last at least as long as your life does."
"Yeah," I said.
"I just wish the whole thing hadn't happened sometimes. The whole cancer thing."
His speech was slowing down, the medicine working.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Gus was here earlier. He was here when I woke up. Took off school.
Yeah."
His head turned to the side a little.
"It's better,"
he said quietly.
"The pain?"
I asked. He nodded a little.
"Good,"
I said. And then, like the bitch I am,
"You were saying something about Gus?"
But he was gone. I went downstairs to the tiny windowless gift shop and asked the decrepit volunteer sitting on a stool behind a cash register what kind of flowers smell the strongest.
"They all smell the same. They get sprayed with super scent,"
she said.
"Really?"
"Yeah, they just squirt 'em with it."
I opened the cooler to her left and sniffed at a dozen roses, and then leaned over some carnations. Same smell, and lots of it. The carnations were cheaper, so I grabbed a dozen yellow ones. They cost $14. I went back into the room. His mom was there, holding his hand. She was young and really pretty.
"Are you a friend?"
she asked, which struck me as one of those unintentionally broad and unanswerable questions.
Yeah, I said. "I'm from support group. These are for him."
She took them and placed them in her lap.
Do you know Monica?
She asked. I shook my head no.
Well, he's sleeping,
she said. Yeah, I talked to him a little before, when they were doing the bandages or whatever.
I hated leaving him for that, but I had to pick up Graham at school, she said.
He did okay, I told her. She nodded. I should let him sleep. She nodded again. I left. The next morning, I woke up early and checked my email first thing. Litowidge.vliegenthart@gmail.com had finally replied.
Dear Miss Lancaster, I fear your faith has been misplaced, but then faith usually is. I cannot answer your questions, at least not in writing, because to write out such answers would constitute a sequel to an imperial affliction, which you might publish or otherwise share on the network that has replaced the brains of your generation. There is the telephone, but then you might record the conversation. Not that I don't trust you, of course, but I don't trust you. Alas, dear Hazel, I could never answer such questions except in person, and you are there while I am here. That noted, I must confess that the unexpected receipt of your correspondence via Miss Vliegenthart has delighted me. What a wondrous thing to know that I made something useful to you. Even if that book seems so distant from me that I feel it was written by a different man altogether. The author of that novel was so thin, so frail, so comparatively optimistic. Should you find yourself in Amsterdam, however, please do pay a visit at your leisure. I am usually home. I would even allow you a peek at my grocery lists. Yours most sincerely, Peter Van Houten, care of Litowidge Vliegenthart.
What? I shouted aloud. What is this life?
Mom ran in.
What's wrong?
Nothing, I assured her.
Still nervous, Mom knelt down to check on Philip to ensure he was condensing oxygen appropriately. I imagined sitting at a sun-drenched cafe with Peter Van Houten as he leaned across the table on his elbows, speaking in a soft voice so no one else would hear the truth of what happened to the characters I'd spent years thinking about. He'd said he couldn't tell me except in person, and then invited me to Amsterdam. I explained this to Mom and then said, I have to go.
Hazel, I love you, and you know I'd do anything for you, but we don't have the money for international travel and the expense of getting equipment over there. Love, it's just not...
Yeah, I said, cutting her off.
I realized I'd been silly even to consider it.
Don't worry about it.
But she looked worried.
It's really important to you, yeah?
She asked, sitting down, a hand on my calf.
It would be pretty amazing, I said, to be the only person who knows what happens besides him.
That would be amazing, she said.
I'll talk to your father.
No, don't, I said. Just seriously, don't spend any money on it, please. I'll think of something. It occurred to me that the reason my parents had no money was me. I'd sapped the family savings with phylloxephore co-pays, and Mom couldn't work because she had taken on the full-time profession of hovering over me. I didn't want to put them even further into debt. I told Mom I wanted to call Augustus to get her out of the room because I couldn't handle her I-can't-make-my-daughter's-dreams-come-true sad face. Augustus Waters style, I read him the letter in lieu of saying hello.
Wow, he said.
I know, right? I said. How am I going to get to Amsterdam?
Do you have a wish? He asked, referring to this organization, the Genie Foundation, which is in the business of granting sick kids one wish.
No, I said. I used my wish pre-miracle.
What did you do?
I sighed loudly. I was 13, I said.
Not Disney, he said.
I said nothing.
You did not go to Disney World.
I said nothing.
Hazel Grace, he shouted. You did not use your one dying wish to go to Disney World with your parents.
Also Epcot Center, I mumbled.
Oh my God, Augustus said. I can't believe I have a crush on a girl with such cliche wishes.
I was 13, I said again. Although, of course, I was only thinking crush, 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 crush. I was flattered, but changed the subject immediately. Shouldn't you be in school or something?
I'm playing hooky to hang out with Isaac, but he's sleeping, so I'm in the atrium doing geometry.
How's he doing?
I asked. I can't tell if he's just not ready to confront the seriousness of his disability or if he really does care more about getting dumped by Monica, but he won't talk about anything else.
Yeah, I said. How long's he going to be in the hospital?
Few days. Then he goes to this rehab or something for a while, but he gets to sleep at home, I think.
Sucks, I said.
I see his mom. I gotta go.
Okay, I said.
Okay, he answered.
I could hear his crooked smile.
On Saturday, my parents and I went down to the farmer's market in Broad Ripple. It was sunny, a rarity for Indiana in April, and everyone at the farmer's market was wearing short sleeves even though the temperature didn't quite justify it. We Hoosiers are excessively optimistic about summer. Mom and I sat next to each other on a bench across from a goat soap maker, a man in overalls who had to explain to every single person who walked by that, yes, they were his goats, and no, goat soap does not smell like goats. My phone rang.
Who is it?
Mom asked before I could even check.
I don't know, I said.
It was Gus, though.
Are you currently at your house?
He asked.
No, I said.
That was a trick question. I knew the answer because I am currently at your house.
Oh, well, we are on our way, I guess.
Awesome. See you soon.
Augustus Waters was sitting on the front step as we pulled into the driveway. He was holding a bouquet of bright orange tulips just beginning to bloom and wearing an Indiana Pacers jersey under his fleece, a wardrobe choice that seemed utterly out of character, although it did look quite good on him. He pushed himself up off the stoop, handed me the tulips, and asked, "Want to go on a picnic?" I nodded, taking the flowers. My dad walked up behind me and shook Gus's hand.
"Is that a Rick Smith's jersey?"
my dad asked.
"Indeed it is." "God, I loved that guy,"
Dad said, and immediately they were engrossed in a basketball conversation I could not and did not want to join, so I took my tulips inside.
"Do you want me to put those in a vase?"
Mom asked as I walked in, a huge smile on her face.
"No, it's okay,"
I told her. If we'd put them in a vase in the living room, they would have been everyone's flowers. I wanted them to be my flowers. I went to my room but didn't change. I brushed my hair and teeth and put on some lip gloss and the smallest possible dab of perfume. I kept looking at the flowers. They were aggressively orange, almost too orange to be pretty. I didn't have a vase or anything, so I took my toothbrush out of my toothbrush holder and filled it halfway with water and left the flowers there in the bathroom. When I re-entered my room, I could hear people talking, so I sat on the edge of my bed for a while and listened through my hollow bedroom door. Dad.
So you met Hazel at support group?
Augustus.
Yes, sir. This is a lovely house you've got. I like your artwork.
Mom.
Thank you, Augustus.
Dad.
You're a survivor yourself, then?
Augustus.
I am. I didn't cut this fella off for the sheer unadulterated pleasure of it, although it is an excellent weight loss strategy. Legs are heavy.
Dad.
And how's your health now?
Augustus.
NEC for 14 months.
Mom.
That's wonderful. The treatment options these days, it really is remarkable.
Augustus.
I know. I'm lucky.
Dad.
You have to understand that Hazel is still sick, Augustus, and will be for the rest of her life. She'll want to keep up with you, but her lungs...
At which point I emerged, silencing him.
So where are you going?
Asked Mom. Augustus stood up and leaned over to her, whispering the answer, and then held a finger to his lips.
Shh, he told her. It's a secret.
Mom smiled. You've got your phone? She asked me. I held it up as evidence, tilted my oxygen card onto its front wheels, and started walking. Augustus hustled over, offering me his arm, which I took. My fingers wrapped around his biceps. Unfortunately, he insisted upon driving, so the surprise could be a surprise. As we shuddered toward our destination, I said, "You nearly charmed the pants off my mom."
"Yeah, and your dad is a Smiths fan, which helps. You think they liked me?"
"Sure they did. Who cares, though? They're just parents."
"They're your parents," he said, glancing over at me. "Plus, I like being liked. Is that crazy?"
"Well, you don't have to rush to hold doors open or smother me in compliments for me to like you."
He slammed the brakes, and I flew forward hard enough that my breathing felt weird and tight. I thought of the PET scan.
Don't worry. Worry is useless.
I worried anyway. We burned rubber, roaring away from a stop sign before turning left onto the misnomered Grand View. There's a view of a golf course, I guess, but nothing grand. The only thing I could think of in this direction was the cemetery. Augustus reached into the center console, flipped open a full pack of cigarettes, and removed one. "Do you ever throw them away?" I asked him. "One of the many benefits of not smoking is that packs of cigarettes last forever," he answered. "I've had this one for almost a year. A few of them are broken near the filters, but I think this pack could easily get me to my 18th birthday." He held the filter between his fingers, then put it in his mouth. "So, okay," he said. "Okay. Name some things that you never see in Indianapolis."
Skinny adults," I said.
He laughed. "Good. Keep going."
Beaches. Family-owned restaurants. Topography.
All excellent examples of things we lack. Also, culture."
"Yeah, we are a bit short on culture," I said, finally realizing where he was taking me. "Are we going to the museum?"
"In a manner of speaking."
"Oh, are we going to that park or whatever?"
Gus looked a bit deflated. "Yes, we are going to that park or whatever," he said. "You've figured it out, haven't you?"
Figured what out?"
"Nothing." There was this park behind the museum where a bunch of artists had made big sculptures. I'd heard about it, but had never visited. We drove past the museum and parked right next to this basketball court filled with huge blue and red steel arcs that imagined the path of a bouncing ball. We walked down what passes for a hill in Indianapolis to this clearing where kids were climbing all over this huge, oversized skeleton sculpture. The bones were each about waist high, and the thigh bone was longer than me. It looked like a child's drawing of a skeleton rising up out of the ground. My shoulder hurt. I worried the cancer had spread from my lungs. I imagined the tumor metastasizing into my own bones, boring holes into my skeleton, a slithering eel of insidious intent.
"Funky bones," Augustus said. "Created by Jop van Lieshout."
"Sounds Dutch."
"He is," Gus said. "So is Rick Smits. So are Tulips." Gus stopped in the middle of the clearing with the bones right in front of us and slipped his backpack off one shoulder, then the other. He unzipped it, producing an orange blanket, a pint of orange juice, and some sandwiches wrapped in plastic wrap with the crusts cut off.
"What's with all the orange?" I asked,
still not wanting to let myself imagine that all this would lead to Amsterdam. "National color of the Netherlands, of course. You remember William of Orange and everything?"
"He wasn't on the GED test."
I smiled, trying to contain my excitement. "Sandwich?" he asked.
"Let me guess," I said.
"Dutch cheese. And tomato. The tomatoes are from Mexico. Sorry."
"You're always such a disappointment, Augustus. Couldn't you at least have gotten orange tomatoes?"
He laughed, and we ate our sandwiches in silence, watching the kids play on the sculpture. I couldn't very well ask him about it, so I just sat there surrounded by Dutchness, feeling awkward and hopeful. In the distance, soaked in the unblemished sunlight so rare and precious in our hometown, a gaggle of kids made a skeleton into a playground, jumping back and forth among the prosthetic bones.
"Two things I love about this sculpture," Augustus said.
He was holding the unlit cigarette between his fingers, flicking at it as if to get rid of the ash. He placed it back in his mouth.
"First, the bones are just far enough apart that if you're a kid, you cannot resist the urge to jump between them. Like, you just have to jump from ribcage to skull, which means that second, the sculpture essentially forces children to play on bones. The symbolic resonances are endless, Hazel Grace."
"You do love symbols," I said, hoping to steer the conversation back toward the many symbols of the Netherlands at our picnic.
"Right, about that. You are probably wondering why you are eating a bad cheese sandwich and drinking orange juice and why I am wearing the jersey of a Dutchman who played a sport I have come to loathe."
"It has crossed my mind," I said.
"Hazel Grace, like so many children before you, and I say this with great affection, you spent your wish hastily, with little care for the consequences. The Grim Reaper was staring you in the face, and the fear of dying with your wish still in your proverbial pocket, ungranted, led you to rush toward the first wish you could think of, and you, like so many others, chose the cold and artificial pleasures of the theme park."
I actually had a great time on that trip. I met Goofy and
I am in the midst of a soliloquy. I wrote this out and memorized it, and if you interrupt me, I will completely screw it up. Augustus interrupted. Pleased to be eating your sandwich and listening.
The sandwich was inedibly dry, but I smiled and took a bite anyway.
Okay, where was I?
The artificial pleasures.
He returned the cigarette to its pack. Right, the cold and artificial pleasures of the theme park. But let me submit that the real heroes of the Wish Factory are the young men and women who wait like Vladimir and Estragon wait for Godot and good Christian girls wait for marriage. These young heroes wait stoically and without complaint for their one true wish to come along. Sure, it may never come along, but at least they can rest easily in the grave, knowing that they've done their little part to preserve the integrity of the wish as an idea. But then again, maybe it will come along. Maybe you'll realize that your one true wish is to visit the brilliant Peter Van Outen in his Amsterdamian exile, and you will be glad indeed to have saved your wish.
Augustus stopped speaking long enough that I figured the soliloquy was over. But I didn't save my wish, I said.
Ah, he said.
And then, after what felt like a practiced pause, he added,
but I saved mine.
Really? I was surprised that Augustus was wish-eligible, what with being still in school and a year into remission. You had to be pretty sick for the genies to hook you up with a wish.
I got it in exchange for the leg, he explained.
There was all this light on his face. He had to squint to look at me, which made his nose crinkle adorably.
Now, I'm not going to give you my wish or anything, but I also have an interest in meeting Peter Van Outen, and it wouldn't make sense to meet him without the girl who introduced me to his book.
It definitely wouldn't, I said.
So I talked to the genies, and they are in total agreement. They said Amsterdam is lovely in the beginning of May. They proposed leaving May 3rd and returning May 7th.
Augustus? Really?
He reached over and touched my cheek, and for a moment I thought he might kiss me. My body tensed, and I think he saw it, because he pulled his hand away.
Augustus, I said, really, you don't have to do this.
Sure I do, he said. I found my wish.
God, you're the best, I told him.
I bet you say that to all the boys who finance your international travel, he answered.
Chapter 6. Mom was folding my laundry while watching this TV show called The View when I got home. I told her that the tulips and the Dutch artist and everything were all because Augustus was using his wish to take me to Amsterdam. That's too much, she said, shaking her head. We can't accept that from a virtual stranger. He's not a stranger. He's easily my second best friend.
Behind Caitlin?
Behind you, I said. It was true, but I'd mostly said it because I wanted to go to Amsterdam.
I'll ask Dr. Maria, she said after a moment.
Dr. Maria said I couldn't go to Amsterdam without an adult intimately familiar with my case, which more or less meant either Mom or Dr. Maria herself. My dad understood my cancer the way I did, in the vague and incomplete way people understand electrical circuits and ocean tides. But my mom knew more about differentiated thyroid carcinoma in adolescence than most oncologists.
So you'll come, I said. The genies will pay for it. The genies are loaded.
But your father, she said, he would miss us. It wouldn't be fair to him. And he can't get time off work.
Are you kidding? You don't think Dad would enjoy a few days of watching TV shows that are not about aspiring models and ordering pizza every night, using paper towels as plates so he doesn't have to do the dishes?
Mom laughed. Finally, she started to get excited, typing tasks into her phone. She'd have to call Gus's parents and talk to the genies about my medical needs, and do they have a hotel yet, and what are the best guidebooks, and we should do our research if we only have 3 days, and so on. I kind of had a headache, so I downed a couple Advil and decided to take a nap. But I ended up just lying in bed and replaying the whole picnic with Augustus. I couldn't stop thinking about the little moment when I'd tensed up as he touched me. The gentle familiarity felt wrong somehow. I thought maybe it was how orchestrated the whole thing had been. Augustus was amazing, but he'd overdone everything at the picnic, right down to the sandwiches that were metaphorically resonant but tasted terrible, and the memorized soliloquy that prevented conversation. It all felt, capital R, romantic, but not romantic. But the truth is that I had never wanted him to kiss me. Not in the way you are supposed to want these things. I mean, he was gorgeous.